Hello and welcome to this pre-record session for Millennial 2018. And this is with Julian Langness, who has the channel Conquering Modernity. Although you had all other stuff going on before the channel, didn't you, Julian?
And welcome to that. Oh, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to talk with you, Wos. I first started writing about the situation in Europe, identitarianism, all this good stuff about 3 years ago, probably about 9 months before you and I met. We were just talking about that at the first Northwest Forum, and first started off writing for Countercurrents and Traditional Right and a few other sites. And since then, wrote a couple books and started a YouTube channel a little less than a year ago. So all sorts of good stuff.
Right. So because I've always wondered this, you spent time in Europe, is that correct? Because your book was called Fistfights with what was it called?
The first one was called Fistfights with Muslims in Europe, and I was almost born in Europe. My mom and dad flew back when my mom was 8 months pregnant. Otherwise, I would have been born in Germany because they lived in Germany in the mid 80s. But I was born here in the U.S. But then we lived over there for about a year again when I was a little kiddo, and traveled over there all the time when I was growing up, and went to family reunions in Norway, that sort of thing. And then I didn't go for quite a while, and I went back again several times when I was, I think, like 16, 19, and 21. And those are experiences I wrote about in the first book that I wrote. And I was sort of a liberal at that point, or considered myself one here in America. But it was really traveling in Europe that kind of awoken me to just how insane our current liberal trajectory was and is in the West, and to what extent it was really just kind of a suicidal religion more than anything. So it had a massive impact on me, and it's definitely, those trips as a teenager in Europe completely changed the trajectory of my life, certainly.
All right, okay. And did you actually get into fistfights with Muslims in Europe? What was that?
Yeah, as I've talked about before, that I titled the book that, and there are a few fights with Muslims in the book that did happen, but in real life, it was more just me being a stupid, degenerate teenager, and, you know, I got in way more fights with other white guys in the U.S., so it wasn't that significant in that regard at the time, but it was sort of one of those things that planted a germ in my head that later on sort of became more of a concrete, deliberate, purposeful outlook on things or way of viewing the world. But I can't give my teenage self that much credit. I was just a drunken idiot more than anything at the time. But it was definitely
okay.
The start of this metapolitical journey of awakening, or whatever you want to call it.
Okay. So now quite a few years later, how would you describe the state of Europe, or would you rather talk about America or Western civilization as a whole? How would you describe what's going on?
Well, it's a good question. I'm always loath to come off like I'm speaking too surely about Europe, because I'm an American, and I try to leave the most kind of concrete stuff to you guys who actually live there and experience it day to day. But it's something I've thought about a lot in terms of the difference between what's going on in Europe versus America, Western Europe, of course. Eastern Europe's doing fantastic. But the way I like to describe it is that it seems to me as though America is a kind of slow motion train wreck that would be very hard to stop or derail at this point. That's just going to continue escalating in kind of some kind of negative direction. I think best case scenario would probably, realistically, best case scenario would be some kind of Trumpian civic nationalism thing where we just keep stuff from getting worse. Worst case scenario would be, just Brazilification over the next 30, 40, 50 years, or even South Africanization, really. In Europe, on the other hand, in Western Europe, it seems more like a sort of fast motion car crash, right? Because Europe had these beautiful, wonderful, homogenous societies until relatively recently.
Like 20 years ago.
Timeline. I mean, even I remember going to parts of Sweden and Norway as a child, and, it was like the Sound of Music. It was just the most beautiful thing in the world. And I know there was already, mass immigration at that point, but there were still, things have escalated there far more quickly. And I think that things will get extremely bad in Western Europe even quicker than they will in America, just because the demographic situation is so fluid. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of countries in Western Europe, like Denmark, Norway, Austria, Switzerland, that could still very easily turn things around completely if they have the political will. So it's just a much more fluid situation than the one in America. Part of that's because the birth rates for native white Europeans are lower than native white Americans, well, white Americans, I should say. And just because the immigration is happening so much quicker, the birth rates among Muslims are substantially higher than among non-whites in the U.S., variety of different factors.
Yeah, indeed. And so that's the sort of demographic situation, but are there other aspects to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the root of it certainly is this religion of cultural and ethnic suicide. And I think that that's really all you can call progressivism. I think Nietzsche kind of predicted it, and it's something I've written about before. Nietzsche predicted that the death, that science would kill God, and that that was kind of a natural thing, that, you know, we as humans would no longer be able to view God and metaphysics in the same kind of childlike surety or wonder that we did through most of human history because of scientific discoveries. And that's, to some extent, a normal thing that was probably always bound to happen as we got smarter as a species and learned more. And that that would kind of kill God, kill religion, and that that would plunge the West into sort of this period of nihilistic self-destruction. And I think that really that's what progressivism is it's essentially a religion of cultural negation, where everything from our past is evil and must be overturned. And that's why I think, even though some people don't like the term cultural Marxism, I think it's really a pretty apt term, because that's really what it is. It's just, you know, labeling certain groups as historical oppressors socially and taking away their power and giving it to the supposed historical oppressed to wield power over them.
Just interject. It really annoys me when lefties object to the term cultural Marxism on the basis that, well, Marx wasn't talking about culture, so therefore there can be no such thing as cultural Marxism. And also they'll say, but no professor has ever called himself a cultural Marxist, therefore it's just something you've invented. Well, no, it's a category that we've conceived of in order to, that very comfortably fits around a lot of these, well, what's been going on. So it's completely an apt term. The fact that we have made it up after the fact or during the fact doesn't mean anything. It's completely correct and useful.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I think it, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what they call themselves or what we call them or what we call ourselves. I mean, basically, it comes down.
Yeah, they know who they are, and we know
they want the West and us to basically disappear. And I think that's part of their sort of metaphysical belief system, this kind of utopian, crazy utopian ideas they have. And, you know, we want our great grandchildren to still live in countries like the ones we grew up in, that we inherited from our ancestors. It's just two diametrically opposed worldviews. And I think that theirs is as illogical and irrational and wrong as is, you know, suicide on an individual level. I guess, not to get in a tangent, there's some situations where suicide on an individual level, you know, could be debatable, but in general, I just think that what is going on in Western Europe today and the West as a whole is just I think it's based in just complete irrationality and insanity, but it's about as close to evil as anything I could imagine.
Now, you say that you were saying about cultural Marxism, that it is Marxism because it's all about the oppressor class and the oppressed class and so on. But how does that lead to what you were saying there, that our great-grandchildren will not have societies like ours? How do we get from cultural Marxism to white European oblivion?
Well, I think very slowly and then all at once, right? Like the great line about bankruptcy. I think that it's happened gradually, and that's one of the problems, is that if at any point in the last 50 years you had shown our forebears what the future would look like and put it up to a vote, I don't believe they would have voted for it. You know, I can't imagine that the indigenous Brits of 1972 or 1958 or 1991 would have been anything but utterly horrified at the reality of today if they could have seen it. But the fact that it's happened so gradually is, to some extent, that inertia is what's allowed it to take place. But I think it's multiple things. I think it's many people, especially among left-wing baby boomers, who just built their identity upon these ideals of anti-racism and tolerance and everything else, and supported mass immigration and other things like that as a result. And 50 years of that has now rendered the demographics of Western Europe and North America, for that matter, completely transformed. And I think there's, you know, other individuals and groups where it was a matter of, you know, selfishness or economic greed. I think there's other, you know, the globalist cosmopolitan element that sort of was engaging in it as a survival strategy in terms of wanting to make our Western countries minority majority countries, since they're minorities. I think it's a whole bunch of things, and it's a horribly complicated situation, but it's also very simple in that, you know, today in Western Germany, 42% of children six and younger are non-European. So unless something dramatically, unless something very dramatic happens, much of the West will be majority non-European by the time my son is my age, if not sooner.
Yeah, and that is a very worrying. Well, Ashley, why don't you explain to people why they should be worried by that? Because, of course, anyone who's watching this who is not of our stripe will think, well, so what if it's non-European? So you explain that for them.
Well, there's a variety of, I think, reasons to strenuously object to such a development or trajectory and to fight back against it. First of all, is that life for our people in such societies would be utter hell. I'm not aware of any majority Muslim countries on earth where they make up 80% plus of the population, where the other 20% or less has a life that isn't hell. And if you look at countries like South Africa, the white minority, it's more dangerous to be a white civilian in South Africa than it was to be a U.S. soldier in Vietnam. So the idea that white people making up 25% of a future Western European country or part of North America 40 years from now would be subject to anything other than daily violence, rape, murder, etc., I think is far too optimistic an assumption, especially when you look at all of human history and just how much violence has been the rule, sadly. I mean, really, peaceful societies with rule of law represent 0.1% of all of human history. They're really a historic fluke for all intents and purposes. Beyond that, though, I think we also obviously have a duty. I think that it's wrong on a level of honor and ethics and morality to throw away what untold hundreds of generations of your ancestors fought and bled and died for. You know, all of our ancestors for generations untold suffered horribly so that we could be here. And maybe not all of them were necessarily thinking 100 generations in the future, but that doesn't negate the fact that they all suffered and bled and toiled so that we could be here. And the idea that within one generation we're going to spit in their face and discard that and basically commit societal suicide is just utter insanity, I think.
Well, absolutely. It's... I mean, again, I can hear the liberals saying, but these societies are ours to do with as we wish. And if we want everyone to benefit from them and enjoy the luxuries we have, then why shouldn't they? You know, I'm always thinking about what is the naive thing that the liberal would say, the progressive, whatever, the NPC would say to what you're saying. I mean, what would you say to that? Why shouldn't the Somali or the Nigerian, or the Pakistani, etc., enjoy the luxuries of Europe bequeathed to us by our ancestors?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's an understandable thing to wonder at. I mean, I'm not anti-morality at all. I mean, I definitely believe that we should try to do everything we can within reason to reduce the collective suffering of humanity and to try to make the world a better place. And I always say I'm like the world's biggest people person. Like on an individual level, you know, I've traveled all over the world and there's very few people I ever dislike on an individual level. Like I've talked with hundreds of people from Africa and Muslims and people from Asia and all over the world. And pretty much almost every human being I meet, I end up liking and thinking of in a positive manner on an individual level. But at the same time, the idea that you can import tens of millions of Somalis into a country like Germany over a short span of time and not have things be drastically worse for all the people involved is nuts. And I think that if we look at the situation honestly in Western Europe, I think even if liberals look at it honestly, I don't necessarily think that life is that much better for all the immigrants they've imported. I mean, I guess in some ways it is, but you know, it's on track not to be. It's on track to be even worse. And beyond, yeah, I think that if we want to, I guess what I would say to a liberal arguing that is that the far better course would be to try to give them the tools to build their own societies into first world countries with rule of law and peace and everything else. And that trying to shortcut that by importing them into Western Europe is just doomed to make everything worse all around, as we're seeing.
Oh, yeah, indeed. So, well, I can't, I mean, I certainly can't disagree with anything there. So let's move over to America now and talk about the situation there. You know, what do you see as the situation and the future for America?
That is a good question. That's a tough one. And I've traveled all over America, too. I've been to every state in America but Alaska. And America is interesting because it's such a huge country and there's so many areas that are really different. I mean, obviously, and I guess that's the case in Western Europe.
It's fascinating, isn't it? See, this is why, and I came to America 2 years ago, as you know, but I only spent a month there, and it just didn't feel nearly enough.
Yeah, it's a whole new world. I know when I would always travel in Europe, people would always assume that, you know, America was like one big city, and they never really realized that most of America is very rural, actually. The town I grew up in had like, you know, 5,000 people in it. But there's just so many different regions too. I mean, if you could go to, you know, an all black, you know, inner city of some giant city in America, you know, Native American Indian reservations, polygamous Mormon, you know, colonies out in the middle of nowhere, Mennonites, there's so many different sorts of people. But overall, my view on America is that I think if all the illegal aliens get citizenship and voting rights, that'll basically be the nail in the coffin of the historic America. At that point, I think the left or some iteration of it will have hegemony at the ballot box and be able to succeed in essentially turning America into Brazil or Lebanon or some other, you know, modern Malmo or something of that nature, London, etc. But I think it's very possible Trump will win again in a couple of years. And while I'm not thrilled with some of the things Trump, you know, hasn't yet accomplished, certainly having him as president is triage, I guess you could say, and it's certainly keeping things from being far worse if Hillary had been elected. But again, like I said, I think the best case scenario in America is that Trump's reelected and then we succeed in reelecting other anti-mass immigration, rational human beings to the presidency after that. And in that scenario, I could see America not doing horrible over the next 50 years. I mean, I could never see it really going back to its glory days of, you know, the 1920s or the 1950s, just because we've had too much mass immigration. And the other difference with America, I guess, is that America was never a beautiful, peaceful, homogenous country at any point in its history. Its history was always basically built upon blood and violence and multiple races and cultures. You know, it has a violent, kind of dirty, complicated history in that regard, in a way that, you know, a country like Norway or Finland might not, at least over the last, you know, 200 years. But I think that in America, we do have decent demographics in some regards and a decent economy. I mean, there's massive problems. We have a massive debt crisis on the way. There's big, big problems, but I could sort of see it stumbling along in a somewhere between what it is now in modern Brazil for the next 50 years, where, you know, things are really bad in the inner cities and different areas, but there's, you know, sort of constantly migrating millions of, you know, white people moving from suburbs to suburbs, you know, as who was it? Was it Lawrence Murray said suburbs are essentially really nice refugee camps for white people.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of room. I mean, you see it, you know, you can drive through these different areas and you see the area that was sort of the suburbia, nice, peaceful, swippily suburbia of the 1950s that's now kind of become part of the inner city and is not doing well. And you see the massive suburbs being built on the outskirts of the towns. It's an interesting dynamic. But yeah, I think America, my best case scenario for America is nowhere near as good as, you know, my best case scenario for Norway or Austria or Denmark at this point. But I don't think the worst case scenario is quite as bad as my worst case scenario I could envision for Sweden or the UK.
Right. So America is sort of in the middle, but simply because of the geographic, the abundance of space.
Yeah. And you still have groups like the Mormons, who still have above replacement fertility. And the Mormons certainly have their problems. They're kind of going the way of every other Christian denomination and, you know, embracing a lot of more liberal things and everything like that. But, you know, you have hundreds of thousands of Mennonites that, you know, you have huge swaths of kind of average middle-class white people in Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, the Dakotas, who all have decent fertility. But if we, you know, give voting rights to the 12 million illegal aliens or however many there are, or if Hillary Clinton had been elected, I think you still would have seen that quickly, you know, things quickly have gone in a very bad direction, because the flip side of all that is that you can import a hell of a lot of third world immigrants into America too, if the political leadership wants to do so. And that's, you know, that's really what we've seen over the last 30 years is this corrupt alliance of Democrats that have wanted all these illegal Hispanic aliens to come here for cheap votes, and these big business Republicans who basically allowed it to happen because there were a lot of people profiting off of it. And then we had this kind of earthquake within the Republican Party in the last few years where people like Trump and Jeff Sessions, Chris Kobach, all these guys basically pivoted in a different direction and said, no, this is utter insanity. We're not even going to have a country left if we continue on this path. So thank God Trump won. Not that, you know, it's made that much difference, but if things can continue on that path, I'm somewhat optimistic.
All right. So having said that, now let's turn back to Europe and the future of Europe, because I know that you wanted to talk about various developments at the moment, including France and the yellow vest thing.
Yeah, and I'm not as educated on the situation in France as I would like to be. I've been following it in the news and everything like that, and it seems like so many things in life, it seems very complicated and contradictory in some ways. And I could be coming off totally ignorant on this, but I believe the yellow jacket phenomenon is sort of these kind of overlapping groups, and there's sort of some ambiguity behind it. In that there's some people in it who kind of consider themselves more left-wing, especially economically. There's some who are more, whose thoughts are probably more congruent with ours. But it does seem as though the Yellow Vest movement is pretty much all native Frenchmen. And I think that that is by itself is pretty significant and a pretty hopeful sign. And the way I've thought about it in Europe for a while is that the best thing that could happen to Europe in a roundabout way would be a really profound, severe economic recession. Because I think that when the economy is kind of humming along average, like, you know, all the young people our age are mostly concerned with just keeping a roof over their heads and, you know, making a decent salary and everything else. You know, we aren't all paid by the government to sit around all day or to, you know, tear the country apart. But, you know, as economic duress ratchets up, people become a lot more desperate and I guess more existentially aware. And I think that hopefully this yellow jacket phenomenon in France and everything we're seeing there is sort of a start to a period of existential awareness on the part of normie Caucasians on both sides of the Atlantic, where they're really thinking about the future. And, you know, if people like Macron stay in charge, what is life going to be like in 10 or 20 years? And it's a pretty, pretty horrifying vision. So, yeah, I'm hopeful. I guess tomorrow is Saturday. We're recording this on Friday, the 7th, and tomorrow is supposed to be their big Act 4. And there's certainly nothing that would make me happier than if they drag Macron out of the whatever it's called and give them what for, so to speak.
Well, let's not go too far. you just mean give them a good talking to, obviously, in Minecraft.
Yes.
But yeah, the I mean, it does seem very difficult to at the moment to work out what the yellow jacket thing represents. But one thing that it does indicate, that it does demonstrate, is that the people can have a say. And I think that, I mean, they can influence things. And what you were saying about how awful things would be if people like Macron were still in charge in 10 years from now, it's worth remembering just how awful a person he is, because the things he's said about, like, nationalism is the enemy of patriotism, things like that, and there is no French culture. Or was it French people? I think he said both things, actually.
Yeah.
And Danish people, Danish culture. There's nothing. Nothing at all. Everything is just, I don't know, primordial soup. Nothing has been constructed or fashioned or sculpted over these thousands and thousands of years. There's nothing of worth, nothing of note, nothing to preserve. I mean, this is the just utter nuts. It's just insanity. And I don't know how anyone could listen to that and think, oh, yeah, my country's going to be safe under the aegis of a man like this.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I, you know, like I said, I went through my own period of liberal insanity in my youth. So that right there is one of the key questions. But I mean, it makes sense in some ways, because I mean, I think that they've adopted a lot of these, you know, kind of virtue, morality ideas from sort of historic religion and turn the other cheek Christianity. But I think it's really just tied to what extent somebody is attuned with reality. Because if you are sort of within the, you know, Davosian crowd or whatever you want to call it, and you've lived in such a bubble of prosperity, and that's something, you know, I think that is a cause of this, is that, you know, most of human history was quite bleak and horrible and violent. And then after World War II, we had this unbelievable period of prosperity and safety. So Macron and Theresa May and Angela Merkel and all these people were born into this, you know, completely unbelievable prosperity and safety and rule of law, unlike anything in all of human history. And that is likely what allowed them to indulge in all these rather insane utopian ideas. If they had had an upbringing the way the people in Eastern Europe did at the same time, which was very tough, or the way their great-grandparents had, I don't think they ever could have given in to these ideas. And I think same in our generation, you know, I mean, we millennials were born right at the cusp of all that insanity. And in many ways in our youth, I think a lot of us were, you know, equally removed from the realities of things. But as we got older and encountered real life and read about history and really saw how things worked, we, you know, were kind of forcibly divorced from these utopian ideas. But somebody like Macron, I mean, it's tough. I don't know if he's just completely duplicitous or if he really does believe all these crazy ideas. You know, it's probably a little bit of both, and it probably ranges for all the different people such as himself. But I just think they're utterly divorced from reality. But, you know, reality has a way of always returning and smacking you in the face just when you're not expecting it. And I think that is what is happening to the West right now.
Yeah, and I think that our leaders, especially in Europe right now, should be aware that reality can do that. You know, they might feel very safe and comfortable, but they, you know, so have many leaders throughout history, just before the reckoning that was always on the cards for them. But they just couldn't see it coming. You know, I mean, Emmanuel Macron does seem to have been totally taken aback by this, this development, these yellow jackets. And I suspect that other leaders throughout Europe will be really watching France very closely to see, well, because it's a taste of what might well come to them, especially, you know, the likes of Merkel. I mean, because I know that there will be many people who despise her, and a lot of European leaders. So, that, I mean, it is a rather scary time for everyone. But, of course, it's been brought to this. You know, as you said, if the peoples of Europe, the peoples of different countries in Europe, had been shown an image of the future in 1958, or indeed 1945, they would have behaved very differently in order to avert this future. They didn't. They would never have wanted this. So, you know, this has been imposed upon us against our will by election after election. So, of course, there was always going to be a comeback. Now, this Yellow Jacket thing might not be that comeback. It might just be a flash in the pan, or it might be a prototype, a sort of precursor, sort of like a forerunner for something coming up in the future. I don't know yet. That's yet to be seen. But certainly, I think it is coming. It's inevitable. And if the native Europeans don't kick it off, then it will be other parties who have been let into Europe who start it up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one way to look at it, I guess, from right now, since we don't know what's going to happen, is that no matter how successful the Yellow Jacket phenomenon is in righting the ship that is France, is at the very least, it'll be another kind of iteration of this virus of nationalism or anti-globalism that is infecting the West. Because every time something like this happens, it makes what seems possible and normal to people grow a little bit more substantial. I mean, if we look at Trump's victory, that would have seemed absolutely crazy 4 years ago. And now that Trump got elected, you know, that virus has taken hold a little bit more. When we've seen even, you know, within our own little, whatever you want to call it, kind of identitarian metapolitics, that's, you know, another aspect of this that's kind of growing. And the Yellow Jacket thing, no matter what comes from it, you know, it's that virus taking hold a little bit more. But I think that power abhors a vacuum. And I think I'm a big student of William S. Lind. I think he's a brilliant thinker, and he writes all the time about fourth generation warfare and how, you know, the 21st century will be defined not by wars between nation states, but basically by wars of non-state actors or non-state actors against national governments. And he says that the greatest enemy of all national governments in the 21st century, whether they're good or bad governments, is basically losing power to the mob, to the non-governmental, you know, body politic or different groups, whether Islamists or nationalists or anything else. And I think that it's increasingly evident that the Macrons and Merkels of the world have sort of a tenuous grasp on authority and on the rule of law. I mean, in some regards, they kind of have an iron hammer or iron fist when it comes to censorship or things of that nature, as you know well. So in some ways, they still seem somewhat omnipotent. But I think that all around among, you know, the right and the left and the Muslims certainly is a growing awareness that, you know, things just cannot continue as they are. I mean, on an economic level, the West is on its way towards utter bankruptcy. On a demographic level, there's the obvious massive problems in terms of societal strife and violence, multiculturalism, all those sorts of things. I think that more and more people have trouble envisioning the Macrons and Merkels still retaining power in 10 or 20 years. And power abhors a vacuum. So I think more and more people are kind of stepping to the fore and trying to step into that vacuum. And in some parts of Western Europe, that could be the Muslims. And in other parts, it could be our own people.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. And that sounds like that was a very fast-paced roller coaster around Europe and America. So it was enjoyable. Okay, well, I'll leave it at that. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
No, I appreciate you having me on. Very good to chat with you. Hopefully 2019 will be a good year, and we'll continue seeing things going in a good direction.
All right. Excellent. Okay. Well, this is Julian Langness, and he's got a channel called Conquering Modernity, which I will link to. Please take a look at it. And okay. Excellent. I hope you enjoyed this. I'll see you later.